The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY with no spaces. And you'll save an additional 20% on these already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout to save big. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Welcome to another Monday morning tech chat show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horrifically named podcast series. But the Q&A is the important part. That's, of course, a question and answer as we like to make each one of these episodes a weekly kickoff. The top tech stories that we've been following over the last week, a little tech and politics, a little gadget news. This week, I'm going to be talking about an app. I found an app last night that I am very excited about. But we really want to make this an interactive conversation so we can sort out our feels. More than just digging into the headlines and commenting on that for one news cycle and then forgetting about these stories, we like to follow up and see what's going on. And I already see, like, incredible live chat brewing for this week's episode. I would like to welcome, what is this, Vasek the Sixth? Their first appearance, first time I keep missing it. The plan I have aligned, and I'm here. I am work from home on a Monday, getting to catch the live stream for the first time. Matt Tyler, Nick Fell, Simon Says Hypno, ER1980, Dave Burns, Kyoto, Walt Samarista, Andy. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. I hope you had a lovely weekend. Whatever you might be doing with family and friends, it's getting to be that time of year, and a few concerns for some of my family. I have to say I'm really thankful. let's start off the week of Thanksgiving. What I'm thankful for, that like my core family, like my parents, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, we do lots of traveling for the holidays. And this year, we've all kind of decided to just put that on hold. We would use Christmas as a big family reunion. Every other year, we try to have a big family reunion on my dad's side, for Thanksgiving on my mom's side. It's tough because more than any other time, with everything that's been going on in the world, being able to check in with my family would be really nice. It would be really sweet, but I am very grateful that my family isn't putting too much pressure on that this year. We started with some conversations in the summer and we're like, well, maybe we could pull off a Thanksgiving or we could do something socially distant. My mom's got this great like backyard area. And the more we got, the closer we got to sort of these end of the year timelines, we all on kind of collectively, but on our own, decided that that wouldn't really be the safest thing for all of our family members, especially our more elderly family members. So it's hard. It's really hard. Thanksgiving is my jam. You know, breaking bread with family or friends, cooking way more food than you really need to. There's the community of sharing food, and I'm not going to get that this year. But I'm grateful that the reason I'm not going to get that this year is because we're all going to work a little harder this year at keeping each other safe. So I'm already seeing Matt Tyler going crazy on the Twitch, giving away some subs. And I am very appreciative of that, Matt. And again, thank you so much for supporting the production on this stream, on this podcast, and on this channel. I really do appreciate it. From Andy, it's a difficult time for family gatherings. I hope everyone gets a chance to sooner rather than later. And Nick Fell, that's actually a great idea. Do we want to do a what we are thankful for in the chat? Why don't we save that for the end? I'm gonna abbreviate some of the conversation, some of, you know, like housekeeping and all that. And I would like to do that. I'm putting together a video for some of the tech of 2020 that I've been most thankful for. And I feel like this would be a good time to also read through your comments and have those conversations and share some of those thoughts too. You know, sort of our little digital slice of pumpkin pie. And I feel like that's absolutely something I would like to read through. But let's tackle that at the end. Let's get through some of this spiky new stuff. And you know what? I'm gonna jump into. So to start off that conversation that we'll finish at the end of this podcast, my hope for everybody during these types of holidays or celebrations, I hope everyone that you care about is staying safe. So, and Ozzy Beachbum, hey buddy, Ozzy man, how you doing? I haven't seen your name pop up in a chat on one of my videos for a while, man. I hope you're doing well. Man, my friend from down under, salute. All right. Yes, because we have a lot to kind of track through. I'm kind of torn. I've got a production calendar full of like phone reviews and comparisons and some videos that I've shot. And increasingly, as we're getting to the end of the year, I'm thinking of pivoting away from some of my normal phone coverage, phone review coverage, and just mostly tackling some more lifestyle tips and tricks, setup, some of the more evergreen content. And I also feel like as we get closer and closer to Christmas, you know, a phone review becomes a little bit less relevant. So I'm a little stuck. I still want to follow up on some of the longer term coverage that I feel like some phones deserve, but I'm less interested in doing the normal phone review patter when most people have kind of completed this year's tech purchases. So just kicking off with housekeeping, I'm not even going to do an over-under on housekeeping. I'm going to run through these pretty quick. And I know I say that all the time, but this time I mean it. Totes for reals. One of the reasons why so few videos made it out last week was because this video was very difficult to put together. This is the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra Camera Conclusion, a steep price for raw capability. The conclusion and the wrap-up of this video are public, and then there's a 30-minute analysis on photos and video samples and just talking about the app, the camera app and performance. And of course, it's a Note, and we're going to be talking about Samsung later. In this podcast, killing the Note line. But considering how expensive these phones are becoming, I feel there's a very important, a very critical conversation to be had about specifying for the consumer. You know, what you're into and how you shoot and what you want to accomplish on a camera. Just because you've spent the most on a phone doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be the right fit for you. And in fact, often what I mean is you could save some cash and still achieve what it is that you care about depending on what it is that you like to shoot. But Dave Burns is absolutely accurate. And this is something we've been chatting a lot on the Discord, especially this morning, is, you know, it's these little mini low power mobile pocket computer chipsets and ARM chipsets that are going into the new Macs are so insanely OP that this literally could be your primary computer. Again, you have to be very particular about what apps and services you use, but I think for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been over this conversation of techies saying like, oh, but I don't know, you need a desktop for this, or you might need a laptop for that. Sure. And legacy software, blah, blah, blah. No, these things are stupid powerful. Your pocket computer is insanely powerful. You should probably be doing more with it. And Gabaletta, I've said this before and I'll say it again, Samsung this year fumbled the cameras in their phones. So if you're on the Patreon, I feel there is some very good evidence for supporting why an ultra purchase might matter to a consumer. In the very same way that I was stonking impressed with the hardware on the OnePlus 8 Pro. That being said, that's a very specific and particular recommendation for someone who has some idea of the content that they want to craft and is not a general purpose, average consumer kind of recommendation. But there is something very interesting happening with these new camera sensors if you have some designs on trying to maximize what they can do, like if you're really trying to push them to their limits. If you're the type of you know, what normal people are going to do with average phones kind of person, and you think I only should have to push shutter button and get the juicy HDR, then no, go get a Pixel. Seriously, I mean, it's so streamlined and it's so easy to use that the Note would be incredibly frustrating. But again, that's in the video. You get a much better sense of that in the video that I actually made. All right, number two, Chromecast with Google TV, the cure for dumb smart TVs. I do not like smart TVs. I think they are the modern equivalent of TV-VCR combos, and they are bad, and the people who make them should feel bad. But you know, spending some time with this Chromecast, I felt like getting a remote was a defeat. I really love the idea of my phone being the control brain interface for a TV. But the reality of that is there are too many products, soundbars, other connected equipment, stereos. You know, you need some kind of single point accessible control stick with buttons. And, setting up and using this new Chromecast, I'm not breaking any news. It's a great little product. And for $50 that you get a Chromecast that streams in 4K, that can load Android apps, and is almost powerful enough to game natively on, and you also get a little like $10 universal remote, that's a pretty good deal. So joining that collection of Fire TVs and Apple TVs and Rokus, I feel like Google has a really good option. You know, again, you don't want to just say, well, you know, the Chromecast is out, that's the one you're going to get. But now that we've got that kind of four-tier competition. Oh, and NVIDIA, Shield TVs. Okay, so like 5 or 6 tier competition. These are great boxes to plug into your TV. The main takeaway is I kind of wish we could just not buy smart TVs. I don't want to pay for the computing guts in a TV that they won't be as good as like the boxes that I'm going to connect to the TV. Like what the Chromecast can do is faster, better laid out, has a smarter UI, is better integrated across all of my apps and services, and is just plain easier to use. And it makes me mad that my super expensive Samsung TV, I've paid for a lot of stuff that I don't want to use on that Samsung TV. And now I have to look up like how to hard reset your Samsung so you can disable the Wi-Fi connection. I mean, it's really a pain, and the way that this is set up is kind of insidious. excuse me. So Nick Fell, it now has actual apps versus just receiving casts. That's true. You're basically connecting, what is it? It's a quad core what are the ARM cores? They're A55s. So they're the low power cores that you would normally find in phones is now the quad core chipset that goes into the Chromecast. If you read the article, I actually did. I fired up Xenowork. It's a cute little arcadey top-down twin stick shooter, and it plays. Not at great frame rates, but it plays. And you can connect, you know, I connected a SteelSeries Bluetooth controller to it. It was awesome. And ER1980, any ideas if Chromecast Ultra will be getting Google TV? I honestly don't know. I would assume no. But that is a completely specious speculation on my part with no data or follow-up from the Google team. And I want to wrap this up. Just one more post on somegadgetguy.com. Split-screen apps, the most underrated feature on your phone. This is kind of what I'm feeling I'm going to wrap up the year on, are these more usage-based kinds of videos. I am super spoiled by dual display. It's getting kind of silly where three apps at a time is starting to feel normal. There's so much that I do around the house, and we're all sort of stepping on top of each other with my daughters. Some of my daughter's online school still happens through a Chromebook, and my wife has a little workstation set up in the living room. And I go a little stir crazy if I'm just stuck in the office all the time. And there's something kind of magic about, you know, like picking up a V60 and having like, you know, a document full screen on the second display and then a Discord and a video on the other screen. And that's just now like normal. Like that's a writing setup that I use all the time. Beyond dual display, though, I kind of feel Google has made split screen more difficult to use than it should be. And it's a shame because it's a hugely underrated feature on these insanely powerful pocket computers. And people should be getting more use out of their phones. They shouldn't be doing the same thing they've always been doing for the last several years. And picture in picture is lame. I think picture in picture is dumb. So it's just a to the point. Tips and tricks video, lifestyle focused. I did a wacky thumbnail because I hate my life. And it's just a kind of conversation that I want to be having more of. Just more use out of these gadgets, less talking about the gadget themselves. I don't know what that's going to mean for the entertainment value of my channel. So, I'm just catching up on a live chat about TCLs and using Roku. Again, I am coming at that Chromecast conversation from the perspective of owning a really expensive Samsung TV that is falling apart on the software. I can't keep Plex streaming. Google Play Movies is constantly buffering. I'm now getting half screen banner ads when I switch inputs. So when I start to toggle over to my PlayStation, I get this banner of like, oh, you could buy this new Crash Bandicoot game for the PlayStation. And you're like, first of all, I own that game. And second of all, why is my ridiculously expensive Samsung TV sending me banner ads, taking up that much screen real estate, let alone serving me ads at all? And I know Google is like this marketing search ad-based economy platform, but you know what I don't get when I'm switching between apps and services on the Chromecast is a bunch of ads taking up real estate on my screen. So, the whole idea of smart TVs, there are some that are better than others, obviously. I have a very low estimation of Samsung TVs in that for the price now. Everything that should be accessible is more difficult. Samsung TV Plus is a major pain in my rear. I hate their built-in TV streaming service that you cannot block or delete or disable. It's terrible malware as far as I'm concerned. And so now I have turned my Samsung TV into just a dumb panel. And thanks to the Chromecast, and I love it. And you know, it's a fine display. It's an okay display. I'm just now really upset that we ever spent this much money on a TV. going with some other solution like LG's UI. We've got an LG TV in the bedroom, Vizio's, some of their solutions. I think those are better. Again, people were bringing up TCL using Roku built directly in. But now I kind of feel like attaching some other computing brain to a dumb display is still better. You know, it's more modular. You can swap out components more easily. If one part dies, you don't have to scrap the whole collection. Like if the panel dies, then you just take your brain and you plug it into a new panel and vice versa. So it's a really sad state of planned obsolescence on these increasingly expensive consumer electronics. And I miss the days like you could buy a TV and expect it to last like a really long, like my parents' Sony Trinitron from the day. Like that was an insanely expensive purchase, but I want to say that TV lasted like almost 20 years. All right. So yes, all of the stories that we're going to be talking about, all of the housekeeping, everything that we're going to be commenting on, you can find in the show notes for this week's episode on somegadgetguy.com. From McCorcoran, yeah, we basically just rent all of our consumer tech products these days. It's like we're constantly leasing stuff. Even when I buy this TV, I don't feel like I own it. And I, you know, when they change the software on it, I get, you know, garbage. And now I have to figure out ways. I'm seriously, like, it's so frustrating digging through the Samsung ecosystem comments and like, well, what's this Samsung TV Plus? I'm never going to use it. And the first thing that returns as a search is Samsung TV Plus is a streaming service that you cannot uninstall from your TV. It's like literally the first Google result is this terrible piece of software is baked into your TV and you cannot get rid of it. So I'm just, it's so expensive. Okay. Moving right along, we do have some a pretty hefty news block that I want to move quickly on. The politics, we're all exhausted by the political process in the United States. If you don't live in the United States, I'm sure you are doubly exhausted by all of the news and commentary surrounding the American election process. And I apologize as an ambassador for the United States to everyone around the world. I'm sorry. So Walt's saying I need to hydrate, and I'm going to take another sip here real quick. So we do have some news that I want to get through. Stories that I feel are now going to become more important again, and just keeping our eye on what's going on. It's been a long-running theme, the commentary on the digital divide in the United States, the households that lack broadband access, let alone the number of people who technically have access to some kind of broadband but can't afford it, and then just how that's wrapped up in carrier policy and ISPs and the way that they do business with consumers, and that we operate in many regions here in the United States in a very monopolistic sense. So when I see a headline like this, this is coming by way of the Washington Post, it makes me both hopeful and anxious immediately at the same time. So this is, who wrote this up? Tony Rahm on WashingtonPost.com. Biden, top Democrats laying groundwork for multi-billion dollar push to boost U.S. broadband. President-elect Joe Biden and top congressional Democrats are laying the groundwork to seek a massive increase in federal broadband spending next year, hoping they can secure billions of dollars in new government aid to improve internet access and affordability and help people stay online during the pandemic. This is exactly the kind of infrastructure investment that we should be making. The reason why I'm nervous is because we've been playing fast and loose with federal dollars, with taxpayer dollars going to carriers and going to ISPs to improve broadband, but then not holding those companies accountable for actually generating results. And so we get these little pockets of investment and infrastructure, smaller carriers, smaller ISPs, like more regional. We'll see some really good feel-good stories from that, but we still don't, one, have any kind of accurate accounting of how many people lack broadband access. between the FCC estimates and then other market analysis, it could be anywhere from 20 million to 50 million households in the United States literally do not have access to broadband, any kind of broadband. And until we can even just count the people who can't get it and arrive at some number that represents reality, we're going to keep throwing money at these companies. If you remember, over a year ago, it was about a year and a half ago, we talked about the lobbyists for the telecommunications industry who doubled down on, broadband should be funded like a utility. It should be funded with taxpayer dollars. The internet is a necessity for business and education and commerce, but all of the profits should be privatized, and you should never be able to regulate the internet, and you should never hold us accountable for using those public taxpayer dollars. We should never be judged by how we use those dollars for our infrastructure. So until we have some kind of regulatory accountability, I feel the more money we throw at this problem, the more that money is just going to evaporate. And from the early days of trying to pay for fiber, we've paid for fiber to home several times over. but we keep writing state laws that entrench monopolistic business practices, and we keep letting these mega corporations tout insane profitability. And then they're hat in hand with, making grabby fist more monies from tax dollars so that we can keep up with the rest of the world. And then it never happens. I mean, for the entire time we've been in California, my upload speeds have gone from like 10 megabits per second to 20 megabits per second. I mean, it's not real improvement. Like it's the fantasy, it's the illusion of competition and the illusion of improvement. So as a liberal, as a left-leaning individual who is passionately interested in trying to find other avenues for broadband adoption, getting more people up to speed, making our economy more competitive, and the fact that we do need to put federal money behind these initiatives, I'm going to be very upset. I'm going to be critically disappointed if it doesn't come with some kind of threshold, if it doesn't come with some kind of benchmark. Like, hey, you're going to get billions of dollars, Comcast. How about you get rid of caps? Because we've basically funded, taxpayers have basically funded huge chunks of your infrastructure. And then you also have to be in these markets and you have to be in these regions because they weren't profitable for you on their own, but we've now funded this. So that has to be accomplished. And if it's not accomplished, you have to give us all that money back. Again, if there's no punitive, if there's no, carrot and stick, then all that money's gone. It just disappears. Dave Burns, I have fiber to home, and that's with just two choices. You're a jerk. I want fiber so bad. I want it so bad. And from Nick Fell, I completely agree with this. It's just we have to fight. I think there are still 20 states with laws on the books. The solution would be to only support municipal fiber as an actual utility. There's precedent in a number of cities. Absolutely, but you have to go state by state. And it's an expensive legal battle. And the entrenched player sues the crap out of that local government. And when Verizon can sue and win against the federal government for the OIO like 10 years ago, a state or a municipal government has no chance. I mean, again, the amount of money that they're going to tie up and burn is just absolutely incredible, unless you're backed by some state law that protects that right for the local citizens to make their own broadband. Or you get some kind of outside funding, like in Chattanooga, where they got a grant from the Department of Energy to build their own municipal fiber. Now it's one of the best and cheapest networks in the United States. So it's really sad. I have no hope of getting any type of significant improvements anytime soon. And again, one of the reasons for this, I'm not going to go too deep into this article. It's just another series of studies and reports. John Brodkin over at Ars Technica is a phenomenal writer keeping up with some of these topics. Broadband power users explode, making data caps more profitable for ISPs. And the write-up on this is great. I mean, again, John Brodkin does phenomenal work in tying together links and following the thread of this over a longer period of time. But the pertinent information here, the number of broadband power users, people who use 1 terabyte or more per month, has doubled over the past year, ensuring that ISPs will be able to make more money from data caps. So at the same time that we've seen almost no evidence to suggest that caps protect network investment or reduce congestion or improve service, none of that has ever held true. All these claims like, well, we're putting a cap on here to protect this or do that, or none of that is real, at least from what data I've been able to find in these studies. All it serves is enabling an additional fee for service from the end user on a service that those ISPs get to double dip on. So they get paid by the content provider, whatever online service you're using, and they get paid from the end user. They get paid at both stages. And then they license their technologies and their interconnect fees. So if one service is really popular, they get paid additionally just to reach different consumers over different network transitions. So they're squeezing as much as they can. And caps, there are rumors that Comcast is looking at enabling caps basically across the country over the next year. But this is a captive market. As we deal with social distancing and work from home, stay at home orders, we're seeing that explosion of work that's being put on consumers to have their own solutions for broadband and digital connectivity. And the ISPs have recently, expired their feel good, loosening restrictions on data caps. All that's gone. So now everyone's back to having caps again, just in time for winter. Just in time for the highest spikes in infection rates for our current situation, and they're gonna be laughing all the way to the bank. They're gonna be squeezing every single one of their customers as hard as they possibly can. From Dave Burns, in theory, Verizon won't have to improve their fiber network after they initially built it because the rest of the nation is so much worse than their current okay fiber network. Without some kind of publicly funded local solution for fiber, then there's no competition. And without competition, there's no reason to improve your service. There's every incentive to just keep making people pay more for the same service. A little bit of good news, and again, not something that we have to spend too much time on, something we need to keep our eye on over the next year, and something I hope we can make some traction on, the U.S. could soon ban the selling of carrier-locked phones, written up by Boone Ashworth on Wired. There we go. Sometimes even when you own a device, you're still not fully in control of it. Buy a smartphone from one of the big U.S. carriers, and it typically comes locked to that carrier's network. If you want to take that phone and use it on a different carrier's network, the process of making that happen can be a real pain. Carriers in the U.S. are required to let you switch networks, and each carrier has its own protocol for unlocking your phone to make that possible. Some processes are more cumbersome than others, but in almost all cases, it's a big annoyance. Luckily, it's an annoyance that may soon be rendered obsolete. So following a recent initiative in the UK and some of the anti-consumer policy watchdog action in the EU, I would be really excited if in the early years of our 5G rollout, we could make this a real go. It would improve a manufacturer's ability to make singular phone models. Wouldn't have to make a UW version on just for Verizon that can't even use the same case. It's like the same version of that phone on another carrier. We have, again, the illusion of competition in the United States, and it would be really nice if it were easier for a consumer to buy a phone, use it on one network, decide, hey, I want to do business with someone else, or I want to go to an MVNO, maybe save a little cash. You go to somegadgetguy.com on the support page. I have a link where you can get a free month of Google Fi. Shameless plug. But that whole relationship would become much, much more accessible. You know, the competition is what matters. And that's what helps us improve a consumer's ability to vote with their wallet. You don't have to worry about, you know, can I get this phone unlocked or it's too much of a hassle. I'll just sign up for a different kind of service and just buy a phone on this new carrier. It's wasteful. And then at the same time, it would just be nice so that consumers had a better understanding of what these phones cost. Because if you ban carrier locked phones, it gets increasingly more difficult to kind of keep a consumer tied to your network through phone leasing programs or these carrier lock-in deals. So instead, we'd probably be pushing buying and owning a phone outright instead of these zero interest loans, you know, instead of making someone think that $50 a month for 30 months is a reasonable price to pay for that crown jewel, beautiful top tier phone. They'd be much more inclined to look at a $400 to $700 phone if it might just as well cover their needs. And it wasn't just the fashion flex. You know, I feel like this is where the UK and EU markets are much healthier for the actual device manufacturers. And Saeed is saying UK made that mandatory, making phones unlocked when you buy from a carrier. I want that here. Oh, and ER1980 is saying the ban here in the UK comes into effect from December 2021. To be fair, apart from EE, Vodafone, and Tesco Mobile, all other carriers, whether MNO or MVNO, already sell their phones unlocked. Again, here in the United States, we have such an entrenched carrier mindset for consumers. That's our smartphone store. You go into the carrier that you're doing business with, and that's where you shop for a phone. And it's going to take time still to retrain consumers that that's not really the relationship they should have. They should have a relationship with the company who manufactured their phone. And then they put a little card or they push a bunch of numbers and codes into their phone and they hook up to a network. You know, it's like, I don't buy my computer through Comcast. I shouldn't buy my smartphone through Verizon. That to me is the generational consumer education that we need to overcome. It's like the reprogramming that we need to do. Yeah, Gabaletta, it was funny to watch being told as a Sprint user for years, sorry, your phone isn't compatible with other networks, to now that T-Mobile bought them out, your phone works with our network now. We have a lot of things that we need to fix. These next two stories, again, a little political content and just something to keep an eye on. As we are often those resources in our families and friends, being a little more tech literate than the average bear, whatever your political leanings might be, I don't really care. I worry that this next story has the potential for some consumer abuse because of all of the parties involved. So it's just something to keep an eye on. Even if you're a right-leaning individual and you know that I'm one of these hippy-dippy liberals, I feel there is something that we can all agree might be problematic. So this is an AP story written up by Garance Burke. Excuse me. Financially troubled startup helped power Trump campaign. I'm not going to dig too deep into this, but basically the main Trump political campaign app for the 2020 election has huge numbers. And it's developed and powered by a developer who in the past has shown issues with keeping up their profitability and their public offering, their stock kind of tanked, and they're tied to a campaign that is sort of notorious for not paying their bills. The numbers on this app are pretty significant. The app lets Trump's team communicate directly with 2.8 million people who downloaded it. And there's the schadenfreude of saying like, oh, well, you know, they get what they deserve, or they get what they asked for. The room for how much information this app tracks on individuals' phones, the privacy policy, the user interface, everything that's kind of tied into that mobile market for those almost 3 million people. And then when money's not being moved around, who is the developer? Funware. Funware is the developer. As Funware has hit challenging financial times in recent years, it has shed employees, clients, and investors, 10 of whom agreed to speak with the Associated Press, some on condition of anonymity because they signed NDAs or feared retaliation. This data is going to be in a very precious and dangerous, precarious position. So as that resource, looking at family and friends, even those of you who might be conservatives, this has the potential to be a pretty significant data security issue. Something to keep on our general radars. If you have, you know, Trump supporting family and friends, and this is one of the methods that they use to kind of keep tied in with the ongoings of the Trump administration, I would suggest trying to broach with them how they might remove that service from their phones and better protect their online data and privacy. It doesn't look good. Cash-strapped developer, probably not getting funded by the campaign like they should be post-election cycle, and sitting on a dump of information pulled directly from these users' phones. I feel that's a bipartisan problem that we should be concerned about. So, yes.
Hey, folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r/glowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
From McCorcoran 3, there's usually a bipartisan consensus against your tech company spying on you. Like, I feel we're all cranky about that. And again, I'm broaching this with a little sensitivity just because of everything that's going on in the political conversation right now. This to me was not a partisan gotcha moment. This to me is, again, the people who are most inclined to interact with a service like this are likely some of the more vulnerable citizens, and our data security is really only as strong as our weakest links. I feel like this is one that we can all kind of agree on. Likely not a great situation. And then lastly, I just wanted to bring this one up too. This is something that I think is an interesting European legal story to follow. Again, how much information is tracked and served by our mobile devices? We have individual manufacturers and their promises of security and privacy. But after a certain point, as soon as you pick up some kind of connected pocket computer, we need to have some very frank and serious discussions about what our expectations for privacy should be and what the realities are of how far someone might go to track consumer data. So this is coming by way of Financial Times. Who wrote this up? Javier Espinoza and Siddhartha Venkataramakrishnan. I did not do that well. Let me go into screen share just so you can see his name. I apologize profusely. I have very little skill at Indian names and dialects. Okay. Apple tracks iPhone users without their consent, claims activist Max Schrems. This is a lawsuit that's going up in Germany and Spain. German and Spain regulators. This is not across the EU. It is not benefiting from the typical EU regulatory action we've talked about with some of these other stories. But basically, they're saying, Max Schrems is saying,
that the identifier for advertisers, the IDFA number on your phone, can be tied to consumer behavior and consumer data, which could be shared without a consumer's knowledge or agreement. This is exactly the protocol that Apple is looking to install on iOS 14 to nuke the connection between advertisers and consumer data by making that policy opt-in. And this is also one of the antitrust lawsuits that Apple is being faced. I mean, again, where most of the time I'm like not really on Apple's side, this one I'm like, well, yeah, I actually kind of want to back Apple's play here, is they're getting sued by app developers and other publishers that interrupting the connection between smartphone users and their advertising software is going to be detrimental, and Apple shouldn't have unilateral control over that kind of process. I feel anytime my data might be served up to some kind of organization, that should be opt in, not opt out. And whenever a consumer is given the choice of opting in, it is a radically small percentage of consumers that decide to opt in. The entire ecosystem, the economy of the internet, needs some kind of market correction, from just blindly profiting off of user behavior to now having users be a bit more aware of their rights and their responsibilities operating on these platforms. So this is an individual lawsuit, which is kind of dovetailing with some of the EU's antitrust investigations into Apple's business practices, but it should be interesting to see where this lands. Again, I'm not sure I fully vibe with the main claim here, that Schrems claim, just having some kind of identifying user number for how so much of our interactions rely on logins and identifiers, and you know, like I set up my own, you know, systems for like how I manage cookies and how I block Facebook from trying to scrape everything that I do in a web browser. At some point, you kind of can't completely escape having some kind of presence in online media. But at the same time, access to that information needs to be crystal clear. I mean, just absolutely simplified, easy to be made aware of exactly where that data is going, because it's overwhelming. It's really not easy to get a handle on all of the permutations. And it feels really good. Apple can put out a commercial, "We care about security." And then they'll also go and get $10 billion a year from Google just to make sure you can't switch the search on Siri, right? They don't profit off of selling user data, but they totally profit from giving user data to Google. It's not as cut and dry as what the marketing might make it seem, which is why it's incredibly important, in my opinion, that we make this process easier to understand. We don't just bury it in a terms of service, legalese, thousands and thousands of words and subparagraphs for someone to chew through with, you know, a lawyer to figure out what they may or may not be doing on their phones. I feel like that is so grossly irresponsible, anti-consumer, and a huge detriment to the future of how we're supposed to exist as a digital economy. So I'll be curious to see how this plays out. I feel like Germany is likely in line to tag a company like Apple pretty hard. And this also sort of escapes some of the like European tax haven going through Ireland. Apple gets to kind of offshore money and not really pay it out. So to me, with Germany being such a driving force in the EU, I feel like their investigation would likely come down harder on Apple, just given the whole surrounding fog of Apple's business practices not being very EU friendly. Dave Burns, yeah, they're not selling your data per se. They're letting Google pay them for it. And from Warhead 324, so more doublespeak. I'm flabbergasted. And from McCorkran, this is the big danger. Most non-tech savvy users have no idea how to change a lot of the default settings that come with your phone. And I want to give Apple and Google a lot of credit that The new process of installing apps, it's a little clearer for people to say, well, no, I loaded this calendar widget. Why does it need access to all of these other things on my phone? It should just access my calendar. Why does it need to do this, 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 and this? I feel like this process still needs a lot of work. We still need to make sure we're helping as many people as we can, but little pockets of improvement. I'm still critically disappointed that Apple is trying to advertise their way out of announcing this amazing privacy protection feature in iOS 14, killing it, or delaying it, I should say, not killing it, but delaying it. So it's they got all the feel goods for announcing it. Then they delayed it. And on the same day they delayed it, they put out a huge marketing campaign about how they're better for privacy and security to obfuscate, to hide the headlines about, them delaying this super hyped and super announced iOS 14 feature. So again, if we allow the tech conversation to just be dominated by Apple marketing slides, we're not really getting a good sense of reality. I'll believe Apple on marketing when I can change Siri search to DuckDuckGo. Then I'll say, fair play, Apple. You actually do seem to care about this, because you letting me change the search impacts your financials with Google getting to lock up and monopolize search on Siri. And until I see that, I don't believe Apple as a mega $1 trillion corporation really cares about my privacy as much as they care about their profitability. They're not altruists. They're a corporation designed to extract as much value from every consumer interaction as they can. That's not magic. All right. Let me get this out of the way. That's the news block. Real quick Reddit plug. Every podcast has a subreddit, and we had an incredible week on Glowing Rectangles this week. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I put out a plea last week that changes to some of the auto publishing that I've been doing have impacted how I've kept the subreddit fed, making sure new content was going to the subreddit. So I put out a general call, we're seeing an uptick in upvotes. We're seeing a handful more comments on individual posts, and we're seeing people really start to invest in some smaller YouTubers. This subreddit is not just about the smallest YouTubers. This subreddit is to help spread attention for any tech-related content we feel deserves more attention. But this last week was an incredible week for some of the smaller players in our community. So if you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, let me screen share back again. A number one, the highest upvoted video of the week, coming by way of MeDo unboxing. He has 4,500 YouTube subscribers. Samsung Galaxy A11 versus Xiaomi Redmi 9. Took the top spot with a bullet. Following that up, we've got Team Vry with 1,000 subscribers checking out the Mi Band 5, a little fitness band. And then just Dank Pods. So 400,000 subscribers coming in the third place position, the best worst headphones ever, with a cute little thumbnail that says conflicting video title. Again, for how much we hate making thumbnails, I actually kind of enjoy that thumbnail from Dank Pods. Rounding this out, we've got Tech Tablets talking about why he's going to return his iPhone 12 Pro Max. We've got Adam Reviews Tech with 1,000 subscribers checking out the Pixel 4a 5G. We've got Dav Tech with 2,700 subscribers looking at the iPhone Pro Max 12. We've got Across the Podcast with Sam and Matt featuring Techspert and Joe Hickey. That was a really fun, chill conversation with a bunch of techie nerds just duding out. Most of the conversation was about football. That was a really fun chat. We've got TK Bay checking out the mini PC stick that I also reviewed. We've got Lisa Mobile Tech Review looking at the iPhone 12 Pro Max. TK looking at how to transfer data from an Xbox to an Xbox. Some carrier commentary. Painfully Honest Tech looking at the new MacBook. Joshua Vergara. Emilio Takas. Gary Explains. Of course, my brother from another mother, Bored at Work, looking at the M1 MacBook Pro for gaming. This week was all over the place. This is like one of the broadest weeks and was one of the most heavily contributed weeks I think I've seen in a while. LFA, The Tech Preacher, we got Easy Computer Solutions, Gadget Byte, we've got Izzy Nobre. We've got Saeed Ted, TED Talks. We've got Technically T. We've got Shannon Morse. This was a huge... Newegg, my video about Fortnite in RTX, actually made it into some of the top listings. Jay Williams, just an incredible week all around for sharing and contributing. So I really do appreciate it. I've worked out a system just for some of my favorite YouTube channels, just so that I can keep auto-publishing and keeping the subreddit fed. It's the same plea as before. We still need the interactions and the upvotes and the shares. And especially like cross-posting. If you're familiar with Reddit, you can cross-post from one subreddit to another. That kind of interaction really helps bring some awareness to where this content is coming from. And then also helps make that individual content more search viable. So someone who has like 4,000 subscribers, 2,000 subscribers, under 1,000 subscribers, and Erica Griffin, one of her videos is automatically going to be popular on this subreddit. In fact, she also made an appearance this week in sort of the mid-pack for some of the highest voted content. But someone who is just getting their channel started or has been working to kind of break through to that monetization, especially now that YouTube is monetizing all videos for themselves, but not for the creators, that kind of interaction helps a lot. So if you want to have a broad, healthy, vibrant tech community, you cannot leave it to Facebook and YouTube. Facebook and YouTube will focus on serving you the absolute most tentpole popular content producers, and you get stuck. If you scan through reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, you will see a much broader tech conversation playing out than what you will ever see recommended to you on YouTube. And if you want to keep up that vibrant tech conversation, that healthy tech conversation, you need to participate. The upvotes help tremendously. Clicking the up arrows on the new videos makes these things more popular, makes them more visible, and it helps search engines rank them higher. If someone's going to cut through, they need that community participation. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This was an amazing week, and I want to say thank you to all the people who have been participating because I discovered a lot of stuff. I found a bunch of new content creators, and there were some really cool videos being put out on a variety of topics. So it was really good times. I think I'm going to start putting together like a master list of who's been shared. Maybe I'll share that on the Patreon. Like I'll lock that up and say like, hey, these are the communities. These are the content creators. This is like who's sharing who. I think it'd be kind of interesting just to see where people are kind of finding new creators and how we can work together to better improve the visibility for all of these new creators. All right. Get this out of the heat. From ER1980, I was tempted to upload the video of Android Andy UK receiving a block of cheese instead of an iPhone 12 mini. Why wouldn't you? ER1980, you missed out on some tasty Reddit karma, because now I feel like someone's going to rush to share that video on Glowing Rectangles, and those internet points could have gone to you. Again, if you want those tasty Reddit points that that don't help you pay bills or anything, but give you the recognition and the credibility on a service like Reddit, you should totally jump on those videos. How many giggle flips can the cheese do? All right. There was a fair amount of obnoxious tech whinging about leaks and rumors. I kicked it. I mean, I mentioned it in the Reddit blog. I kicked it from the show list just because it's so depressing. But, you know, YouTube is going to be YouTube is going to be enabling monetization on all channels. They're just turning on ads. And if your channel hasn't been approved for the creator program and to monetize, then YouTube just pockets all of that money. If your channel is super, super big and you depend on like sponsorships, like I think Jim Sterling is, you know, we're seeing ads on his videos, even though he does not serve ads on his videos. Well, too bad. Too bad. YouTube is going to also make sure that they're serving ads on that too. So I'm disappointed in that as a business practice. I felt like that was about as much a commentary as I could stomach right now, just because I think it's such a bad look for YouTube. And it seems so like ungrateful of the content creators that keep people coming back to YouTube as a service. But, you know, I just got my silver play button from YouTube, so, you know, everything's super cool and groovy on this side. And Aditya is saying I should hydrate, so I'm going to do that. From a Corcoran, why don't they just make half the screen an ad at this point? You mean like my Samsung Smart TV? Okay. We got, one of the reasons why I'm a little twitchy about where we get at the end of the year. People are still buying phones. Phones are probably going to be computer holiday purchases. You know, we're getting into the end. I don't believe there is like this one window to buy a phone and then the phone is obsolete or outdated, or you know, if your argument is, well, you should wait and get this new technology, then you're always going to wait. You know, you'll never be satisfied with a tech purchase. I'm about halfway through finishing my script for the OnePlus 8T. And some things about this phone that I think are really interesting competing points against some of the foregone conclusion phones, like the Galaxy S20 FE, which still seems to be having some touchscreen issues. But of course, that's the phone you should buy, regardless of what other features, because Samsung made an S20 that was a little bit cheaper. And who would ever want to buy a different competing device with similar specs, even if it's a little bit more expensive? You know, like that mindset and that mentality, I think, is hyper toxic to the tech community. And it also turns off, I think, the outside viewers and the average consumers who now don't take us seriously anymore. So I'm spending time with the OnePlus 8T. I'm still going to be putting out a video on my longer term experiences using this phone. And we're already baiting the hook for those tasty clicks and views for next year's phones. So OnePlus 9 Pro leak hints that curved screen is here to stay. Cool. I already know too much about the OnePlus 9 now. I want this stuff to be fun and a surprise and a discovery, and we're already leaking to death another phone. So this is the OnePlus 9. Probably going to be a OnePlus 9 Pro, you know, having the larger camera bulge and the curved screen. And I get it. We've got to drive traffic. I just don't feel like there's anything super precious about this conversation here, except to start the process of making people feel unsatisfied with the current tech that they own. So fun, I guess. I don't know. This is why I hate covering leaks and rumors, and it just drives so much of the insta knee-jerk social media style conversation that we have. It just takes so much fun out of the conversation. But I'm looking forward to a OnePlus 9. I feel like the OnePlus 8 Pro was one of the more underrated phones of the year. I mean, what that phone does at the price that it launched at and how competitive it was against the competition it launched against. The OnePlus 8 Pro is one of my happiest my happiest review periods. That's not how I want to say that. Actually, the happiest surprises of the year. There's so much that that thing does so well. And again, if you're hyped up like, oh, people focus on the camera too much, like that camera hardware is phenomenally good. And especially if you really care about your content, like the raw files you got out of the OnePlus 8 Pro are just insanely formidable. I wanted to piggyback this also after having recently spent some time with the Galaxy Note, and a video that I think I'm going to wrap up 2020 with is talking about the death of the Note, because it looks like the Note's pretty much gone. Next year, we're looking at a Galaxy Z Fold 3 with stylus support, and that stylus support has been rumored to be included on the S21 Ultra, the Ultra variant of next year's S20 series. So I'm going to be sad. As someone who was a diehard Note user who keeps a small collection of Galaxy Notes, still uses the Note 4 as a regular studio assistant, like especially for, you know, like notes and for my teleprompter software. It's just so there hasn't been a phone that's been better for that kind of use than my Note 4. I'm going to be sad to see the Note line properly discontinued. I think it makes more sense for Samsung having so many different flavors and variations and parts bins and the FE editions and the Ultras and the Pluses. And it's just dumb confusing at this point how many phones Samsung puts out. It's something I wish they would just copy LG. V60, Velvet, Wing, and to a lesser degree, the Stylo all support a capacitive, an AES, an active electrostatic pen. Like, just do that. Have like a proper stylus with buttons and shortcuts and commands, and any phone can use it. Just build that tech into every phone, and then someone can decide for themselves if they want to add a stylus to the equation. There's a fly in my office. So Nick Fell, is it the death of the Note if the S Pen lives on? The death of the Note, I feel, kind of already happened, and I think it was showcased this year. The Galaxy S20 Ultra was a more aggressive attempt at pushing the boundaries of Samsung smartphone manufacturing than the Note was. And the Note used to represent that end of the year, everything in the kitchen sink, most crown jewel tech platform. You know, it was the most Samsung that Samsung could make. And that's not true anymore. I feel like the S series has eclipsed the Note series as being that. So that's why I'm sad. I'm not sad that there's not going to be a phone with a stylus silo. I would actually prefer just all phones have stylus support, and then you can buy a stylus if you want to use it. I would rather that cavity in the phone go towards giving me a bigger battery, right? The practical differences between using the Note as a daily driver for almost a month and then using my V60, the S Pen is more polished, has more fun little gimmicky features. And we don't care about gimmicks when they're on Samsungs. It's just value add when it's a Samsung. But bigger battery on the V60. Win. I have almost exactly the same pen experience for actually using the pen, minus like the smart translation features when I'm looking at other websites, not in Chrome. Other than that, I'll take the more battery. The V60 is such a battery champ. I love it. And it properly beat the Note for my use. Win. I have a pen and a bigger battery. That's what I want. It's just sad. it's the feeling, the emotional, it's irrational. It's the emotional feelings over a label. And the Note and the Active were my labels. Those are the products that felt like they were built for me. Increasingly, the Note has not felt, especially after losing the headphone jack, has not felt like it's been built for me, and they just don't make Actives anymore. So Samsung has properly walked away from the two main devices that I cared the most about. And that makes me sad. I mean, again, just I totally grok why tech nerds get pissy with OnePlus. When, you know, OnePlus used to be a very specific kind of tech conversation in the Android enthusiast space. That was me with the Galaxy Active. The Actives were the best. hands down. Flat screens, smaller screens, bigger batteries, rugged construction. We're the first to properly support not only IP, but mil-spec, drop-in shock resistance. You cannot tell me or convince me that any follow-up Samsung device has been better than the Actives, because you're wrong. as a lifestyle durable device, and now as the father of a five-year-old who really loves testing the gravity of different consumer electronics, Actives. Actives were my jam. So I'm just sad. Again, it's another thing that, like, I think Samsung is looking at Apple and you're like, well, Apple sells a tablet and the tablet doesn't have a stylus silo. And then they get to charge an extra $100 for a special Apple Pencil. And we could do that with the Note and with our tablets too. Why use this space for something in the phone if someone cared about always having a stylus with them? And instead, well, we can make it an extra accessory that they need to buy. And the Ultra is still going to be a $1,400 or $1,500 phone. And now you'll get the Note with an extra $100 S Pen purchase on top of that. Cool, I guess. I'm going to be cranky because I doubt the S Pen is going to be more universally compatible. I mean, the nice thing is, you know, like, I hold up these different pens. I use a Wacom, and then I also have a Lenovo. So this is a Lenovo AES pen. It's an active stylus. It works on a variety of Windows PCs, and it works on LGs. I feel like this is a better pen tech to invest in because it's a little more broad. You can take this pen and move it to a couple different products and a couple different solutions, and I like that better. If it's an S Pen, something tells me it's really only going to work with Samsung phones and tablets. Will it work with a Samsung laptop? That'd be cool. That'd be really cool. I haven't seen any commentary on what's going to happen there. So it's just a bummer. It's just really a bummer. And Dave Burns, the S8 Active was pretty great. And it was like the last one and I didn't keep it and I should have kept it. I should have worked harder. I mean, like, I should have bought it off of Pocket Now. That S8 Active was such a stonking gorgeous phone. I loved that phone so much. And it was such a nice improvement over the S7 Active, where I feel like the S7 Active wasn't really built that well. The water resistance, we killed it pretty easily. Trisha Hirschberger killed it at a water park. It wasn't too hard for her to wreck that phone. I feel like that was the low point. The S6 Active is still, I think, my favorite just overall in terms of design and durability. But I the S8, man, it's just making me all weird and sad about old phones and things that we just don't get anymore. From Matt Tyler, it would benefit Samsung to enable pen support on all of their high-end phones, but have special features for the S Pen. I don't think they will do that, though, because they're different pen technologies. You don't want to increase the cost of the screen manufacturing to include digitizer support for S Pen and Wacom, or for AES. You're probably just going to pick one. And they're entrenched in their S Pen tech, and it's good. I mean, it's really good. But that's also what makes me a little cranky, is it feels like an Apple move. It feels like Apple lock-in. If I do this, well, I should really only own a Samsung tablet. If I do this, I can't really use it with other PCs. You know, like, I want a more Lenovo style, where it's a pen tech that works on ThinkPads and you just move it right over to a phone and you get the same experience. Like, you don't have to put it down and pick up something else. I want that interoperability. From McCorkerin, Samsung fans will call the discontinuation of the Note courageous. Actually, I believe Samsung consumers are going to be annoyed. But I bet you techies, while they're clutching their pearls now, next year is going to be all about, well, yeah, I mean, it just made sense. It was the right time for Samsung to do it. And the Note was this and that. And the S has always been better. So if you really want the silo, then you can just buy a Z Fold 3, which is going to be like a $2,500 phone. I mean, if that's what you need, then you should just do that. Watch, all of these channels are going to flip on it. You know, from last year to this year, you already see that kind of Well, I mean, yeah, I guess the Note's kind of over. It's just a Galaxy S with an S Pen. And next year, they're just going to, whatever Samsung marketing tells them to think, they're just going to follow it right up. Where before, it was a deal breaker on my V60. I almost dropped my V60 on the floor. That would have been hilarious. It's so easy to lose a stylus. I mean, it's just so much better to have the stylus built into the Note. I mean, it's just common sense. Why would you ever want to have a stylus that doesn't slide in there? I mean, yeah, you can say you like your Microsoft Surface Duo and the magnet sticks the stylus to the outside, but I mean, it's not going to be as good as a stylus silo. And next year, it's going to be all about. I really like how Samsung is giving consumers a choice, and you don't have to buy a phone with a built-in silo and you get the bigger battery. They're going to flip it. They're going to flip it every single time. Simon says hypno. Note death. I was wrong. And they're going to do a wacky shocked face. This is my thumbnail because my mind has been blown by how much better this is now and my expectations subverted. I hate tech YouTube right now. It is so annoying. So annoying. Tech Lovin' Mom is in the chat. Everyone say, hey, Tech Lovin' Mom, as I get another mug of water. So, should be interesting to see. Z Fold 3 might be the first Z Fold that I try to spend some time with beyond just kind of casually poking at it. I'll be curious to see how they make folding screens work with fine point stylus action, because I just still don't trust a bendy foldy screen to be as durable for the type of like pressure sensitivity that you'd really want in a stylus. So I'll be curious. I just don't believe yet, until I can see it, until I can really get my hands on something like that. I just don't believe it's going to be as durable. Because this is also going to be an increasing trend. I feel like we're going to see LG's next Explorer device come out, you know, after sort of the success, the positive mind share of the Wing. I love my Wing. Another one of the happiest surprises of 2020 was just how well executed this concept really is. And there's the Korean update for the Wing already looks kind of incredible. And I'm sad that, you know, I'm sitting on Verizon waiting for them to push this update out. But with their next phone, probably going to be some kind of scrollable device. I'm really hoping that we'll see more of some of the TCL experiments, because I like the idea of a scrolling phone a little bit better than a folding phone, just to save some of the space and the thickness of folding the phone in half. You get twice the pocket density as opposed to a scrolling phone, where when it's in normal phone mode, it should be a little bit closer to a normal phone. So Oppo put out their concept. Oppo's X2021 rollable expands in your hand. This is written up by Richard Lai over at Engadget. And I feel like this is going to be right in line with what LG was showing off too. Now, not for stylus input, obviously, but this is the frame I think is going to be more successful than the Z Fold concept. I feel like having the screen sort of expand outward and scroll, and I love these little GIFs that show like as the screen like actively reformats the shape and size to the dimensions of the physical display. I think this is going to be a more successful concept for how to accomplish this kind of action. Again, pros and cons, because we're talking about this is a motorized scrolling device, and I'm sure that it's going to be more susceptible to pocket lint, to dust, to grit. You know, get a grain of sand in there, it's going to wreck your day. But if we're going to say that making a more fragile device that turns into a tablet-y form factor, I'm more interested in this than I am in something that's going to bend and have a hard crease down the middle, has gaps on the sides that make that dust and entrance more accessible, and doesn't fold up into a more traditional phone shape, folds up into a double thick phone shape. So I'll be curious to see. I think this is going to be the interesting battleground happening in 2021, watching how this kind of scrolls and closes and shuts. Still bigger than a normal phone, but I think going to be more pocket manageable than a than a folding phone and not having to worry about those hinges. Dave Burns, moving parts. Simon says, Hypno, one wrong touch in the pocket and your friends are going to start walking away from you. Yeah, it's like, I'm just going to start introducing, like, I'm not happy. I'm not excited to see you. It is just a folding phone in my pocket. My phone scrolls out. It happens. I just, you know, my pants are tenting because of my phone. Nick Fell, the scroll is probably the most useful form factor enabled by flexible screens. I still hate the cheap plastic feel of flexible screens, though. I'm telling you, for how much I just adore dual display. I like that it's glass. I can't wait for, you know, newer versions of like Corningware, like Victus or whatever they come out with next to better improve the durability as you close the device. You get the absolute correct, perfect full wraparound. You can go from a tent mode to propped up like a laptop to single screen. The Duo for its rough spots and its issues is the most glorious execution of a multitasking computing device. And I just absolutely adore the hardware on it. It does need some more software polish, but, you know, it's been getting better. It's just still has a lot of room to be cleaned up. But if you're telling me, you know, like, I'm going to fold the screen in half and pinch that crease and still have open areas for lint and dust and dirt, and it's still going to be less durable, and I can't game on it for the way that I rub my thumbs against plastic in a different way than I might rub my thumbs against glass, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. So if I'm going to have to suffer this fragility, I might as well get it without a big old screen crease running down the middle. Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week. And we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. Twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called The Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
From McCorcoran 3, the crease really looks awful, at least online anyways. You know, the thing is, like, I've handled the Fold 2 a lot. I mean, I've played with it quite a bit, especially, like, sitting down with TK when we were doing our phone swap challenge. Like, you know, we were sitting on opposite sides of a park bench, but I really dug into that thing. And the hinge is awesome. Like, Samsung's engineering is pretty incredible. I don't feel it's a real device. I really don't. And I love, like, oh, well, once you start using it and you get used to it, you don't even see that seam anymore. And, like, I disagree, especially because of how I've spent time with dual display phones. Your brain never really lets go of an interruption or distraction when it's, like, right smack dab in the middle of content. You know, like, dual screen gaming on the Duo is a no-go. Because there's that whole strip running right down the middle, and it's minimalized, but it's still impacting that experience. And the same thing happens with the Z Fold. I can't look past it. I can't unsee it. And that makes the extra real estate more valuable to me for multitasking. So I can keep two full screen apps running at the same time. But if I'm going to do that, I can do that way cheaper and I think more effectively on dual display. I think it's way less expensive, same practicality. Like, I love showing, you know, like, who was even like Mr. Mobile was like, yeah, look at the Z Fold 2 and I can tilt the screen halfway up. Isn't that great? And at the same time, I can't think of any benefit for dual display on my Velvet. And you're like, that's exactly the kind of use that you claim to love on a Z Fold 2 and that you wrote off on a dual display phone. So it's that kind of like, well, but I mean, like, this is obviously superior because it's more expensive than Samsung. Just doesn't fly for me. It just doesn't vibe. Oh, that's actually a good one. So Matt Tyler redeemed a poll, suggesting a poll, scrollable, foldable, or dual screen. Let me see. Can I add that really easily here? So I'm not very good at editing my Twitch on the fly. I don't think I can. My panels are all messed up and I'm real bad at the Twitch. So I'm gonna have to unfortunately make this a poll in chat. Sorry, Matt. I will get better at the Twitch so I can make that happen for reals. My apologies. Well, so someone's asking, Walt saying, well, what about swivelable? And JMX Warrior, exactly. I would consider a swivel screen a dual display. It's an unequal dual display, but it's two uniquely distinct screens that provide for additional functionality or multitasking. Dave Bonine, is cost an issue? Yes, it is. Because I feel, you know, if you're going to compare dual display to folding screen, you're comparing, you know, what, you can pick up a V60 on a Carrier for, what, $600? So you're comparing something at like the $700 price tier to something in the $2,000 price tier. So are you really getting $1,300 more use out of something with no stylus support, and it's way more fragile, and has no IP rating, and the big perk is the exact same perk as the swivelable hinge on the dual display case for the V60. So, discuss. Dave Burns, V60 is a great value in every argument. I don't disagree. But yeah, so Oppo, we're going to be seeing that concept coming out. They're also talking about some new AR glasses. I'm going to be really curious to see what they can pull off there. And then, just to wrap up our tech block, before I get into a little app plug, and I don't do a lot of app plugs, so this is a big deal for me because I am very Twitter-pated, with this app that I found, but I just want to highlight whenever I have the opportunity to. The absolutely incredible work that the team at iFixit does. They are one of my most primary resources for getting an understanding of how our consumer electronics are made, how they're repaired, how they're serviced. And they've been a driving force in the conversation and commentary for me personally, in how we should respond to the challenges against things like right to repair legislation. In any way that you can support, buy from them directly, watch their YouTube videos, go directly to their articles. Like, I'm bringing this up now, and I'm bringing this up because I really want you to go to ifixit.com and read through this article and not just read through a headline on someone else's blog with a crap summation of what they found. So, they have put out their M1 MacBook teardown. This is written up by Sam Goldhart. And I love that they're copying this dopey image that so many other YouTubers have done, where they're like chin on table, face basking in the glow of the amazing power of Apple Silicon. And instead, they've ripped open the guts of a MacBook and the backlight of the display is kind of shining in their face. And I just thought it was a cute little take on this like trend of overhyping Apple products and making them seem like magic. They're so magic. No, this is a great teardown detailing the differences between the MacBook Air and the new fanless MacBook Air, and talking about some of the components that have made the transition, and then breaking down like the actual like M1 computer components and how everything is fused to this logic board now. The move to ARM is coming with another step of not being able to service, support, repair, or upgrade an Apple computer. And we're finding this in the Mac Mini, and we're finding this in this new MacBook Air, and this is going to be another generation to see if this is the trend that continues with iMacs and Mac Pros. It does bring a consumer benefit. The M1 chip, I am very impressed with the numbers and the performance coming from this chip, being able to improve some of the security features by moving it on chipset. There, instead of having a separate coprocessor just for security, it's now a secure part of the M1 chipset. But this write-up and this teardown is absolutely incredible for just detailing what it looks like on the inside of this machine and some of the concerns that we're going to face. Where you might even look at a MacBook Air and think, well, maybe the only thing I might be worried about is in a couple years, I might need to maintenance the batteries, right? Well, we also know that Apple is serializing all of those parts. And if you make a MacBook more like an iPhone, it might be increasingly difficult to source MacBook batteries if Apple decides that they're not going to make them available to third-party repair shops. And if you go to an Apple store and they decide, no, you know, your MacBook Air is getting a little too old, I guess there's just nothing we can do to fix it, then you have to buy a new computer. And Apple gets to control the entire vertical on the consumer side and on the repair side, on the actual commerce of buying that product, supporting it, maintaining it. You can't upgrade it. The pie is baked. Like it is done. But even if you want to try and extend the longevity of it, Apple gets to decide for you when your computer is completely end of life. And that's the thing. That's, again, it's that last part of the control. It's the last part of the consumer experience. We've kind of given up on other mobile devices like tablets and phones. And there's just something about a laptop or even a mini desktop or an iMac. I still feel like that shouldn't be the case. I am ineloquently adding to a conversation that I think iFixit has done much, much better. iFixit.com, check out their teardown, the MacBook, the new M1 MacBook, talking about the cooling, the MacBook Pro. Give it a read. It's really interesting to see what actually goes inside our products here. Oh, McCorkerin is giving me a posture. Oh, Kieto and Gabaletta also giving me posture checks. I know it's not a stretch, but because all three of you did it, I'm also going to add a stretch in there too. Simon says, Hypno, iFixit were such a boon when I repaired Macs. Their teardowns and the way that they're shot, the way that they, the photography that they do for these teardowns is just so simple and it's so clean. You get to see exactly where everything is. And I don't know, there's that nerd hardware experience. I almost made sort of a comparison to another adult industry that probably would not go over well with YouTube and their censorship. But it's just so pretty. And it's amazing. It's amazing to see what actually goes into making these products. Because it's not as simple as we try to make it sound, you know, like, well, it's got this Qualcomm Snapdragon and you can get that at a bin price of like $300. So there's no reason why a phone should cost more than $400. Like, no, engineering and this type of development and this type of, you know, like how you cram all of the guts inside this product is insane. And I think it's kind of incalculable for the average consumer to figure out exactly how much this stuff should cost. Dave Burns, R&D costs money.
And Jim Simon says Hypno. They are so clear about weak spots, delicate cables, things to be wary of. Even just seeing like how awesome their process is for popping glass off of glue. That's the thing that freaks me out the most, is like trying to get the back off of a phone these days is the main pain point. Just because I have zero faith that I'm going to be patient enough to not just like crack the back glass off trying to separate it. It's just so messy. Okay. So this was a big deal for me. We're getting to just an app plug. They are not sponsoring this podcast. I have no relationship with these developers. This is TS Systems made this app. But I just wanted to share just a brief story of one of the new challenges that I'm trying to tackle for some of my phone reviews and benchmarking. When I benchmark something like a phone, I am making the argument that we should be using phones more to replace some of the other general computing situations that we face. I feel increasingly, especially with this move for Apple going to Apple Silicon and the new iPads and the iPad OS updates, more and more the power of what's in one of these little portable guys is more than sufficient. It is overpowered for the vast majority of your general consumer computer interactions. So a phone at $400, $500 already perfectly adequate, above adequate, better than adequate for tackling the real daily driver, average user smartphone needs. And it's a powerful enough computer, we could be driving them harder still. Especially when I started playing with like the Pixel 4a, the iPhone SE. I mean, again, it's just silly how much compute power is going wasted in those products. So I've been trying to keep up with a series called By the Benchmarks. I'm no longer going to be doing them as videos just because it's too much work for the traffic that those videos get. Especially if I try and do a By the Benchmarks on a phone that's not as search popular. Like if I only ever do videos on Samsung and Apple, my channel would be way more profitable. But I still want to keep up this conversation because I think it's so valuable in trying to test with real world apps and services. I take a very loose benchmark from Geekbench just to start the conversation, but we all know synthetic benchmarks are not real world performance. I don't do my work in Geekbench. The Geekbench score doesn't tell me if my work is going to get done. And so over time, I've been adding to this. When I started at Pocket Now, it was just a very simple video transcode test. Now I do a longer video transcode and a video render with transitions and with a watermark and with audio. So it's more of a YouTube style project in which $500 and $600 phones can regularly spank the crap out of $1,000 PCs. On top of that, I've started expanding into some other areas where I feel our phones can replace laptops, or at least enough in the moment where the immediacy of having our phone might make up the difference of trying to move that activity to another computer. Things like file compression. You know, you need to open up a bunch of RARs or zips or 7-zips or whatever it is, you know, your compression of choices, or compress a bunch of files and send them off into some sort of cloud storage. I've been testing, I've added a podcast render. So if you wanted to record an entire interview from your phone and add music elements and ad blocks and render out, you know, and mix down a full produced audio show, it might be more accessible and faster to do that from a phone, depending on how you set this stuff up. And then you wouldn't have to travel with a laptop to get that same work done. So working with O'Shea on the Discord, sorry, someone's trying to call and I have my Google Fi linked with my browser. Actually, the new Google Fi link to messages for the web, really nice, but not so nice when I'm in the middle of a podcast and it tries to hijack my audio when I'm talking to you fine folks. So talking with O'Shea, one of the tests that we want to add to this is batch photo processing, is to see, like, you know, you're out in the field and maybe you're shooting from like a proper camera. Would your phone be a reasonable solution for editing and finishing a bunch of photos and then doing a batch of those photos? And we can get a real sense of what does it look like in the field. Immediately, the first app that comes to mind is Adobe Lightroom. If you want to edit a photo, please use Snapseed for just taking an individual photo, even an individual RAW file, because it has RAW support. It's beautiful. It's great. It is a phenomenal single photo editing app. Very few omissions. I mean, I wish it had better support for like noise, handling Luma and Chroma noise. But other than that, I mean, it's just a terrific, fast, powerful image editor, and it's free. Snapseed is great. But if you want more, the immediate consideration is Lightroom. Lightroom has been paywalling a bunch of their extra features like batch processing. Batch processing doesn't affect Adobe servers. Batch processing is a component of the power of my device locally chewing up each individual image. And I am not going to pay Adobe subscription fees just for the benefit of getting to use my phone processor a little bit better. In the Android ecosystem, it is incredibly difficult to check all of the boxes. I don't want a subscription. I want some of the advanced photo editing tools, like better noise reduction capabilities, better curves, and better coloring tools for photos on the device. And I want the ability to, like, if I'm out shooting and I take a burst of photos and I kind of want them all processed in generally the same way, I want to be able to batch that process. I don't want to have to replicate it for each individual photo. There is literally one app that ticks all of those boxes and is a single purchase. You pay once, and it's only $10, which is awesome. So allow me to introduce you to PhotoMate R3. So this is going to be added to my lineup of benchmarking situations. And I'm going to be doing this kind of ridiculously. I've got 200 raw photos taken from a Sony a7 III. So each raw image is almost 50 megabytes per image. And we're going to dump them all into PhotoMate with, you know, just some basic image image adjustments. I'm not doing anything too crazy, but it's mostly like, you know, a slight white balance tweak, exposure contrast, some shadow, white point, black point, and then vibrance and structure details. And then I'm just going to time how long does it take to chew up almost 9 gigabytes of photos as a regular benchmark. Because I also wanted this to be another torture test. So what's been fascinating is I'm keeping a time on halfway. So once it gets through 100 photos, takes a certain amount of time. As the phone continues to work, do we see evidence of thermal throttling for the second 100 photos? And how well does your phone actually sustain a pretty intense workload as it moves through each piece of this photo editing chain on each image, which is around 50 megabytes per image for 200 images? Again, that's not something that I feel is like necessarily this is what consumers are going to or should be doing with their phones. But I'm kind of double dipping. I'm using this test. One, the first half of it, I think, is kind of a reasonable expectation of a photographer using this with a real camera out in the field. And then the second half of this is, how much does this sustained workload really slow down our phones? You know, it's kind of impressive. I've run it on the OnePlus 8T, the V60, and the Xperia 1. 200 photos. Almost 9 gigabytes of data, individually compressing these down into very high quality JPEGs And these phones are rocking these tests in something like 14 minutes, which isn't bad. Like, again, I don't shoot that way. I'm not a photographer who's going to edit that way. I don't think many photographers are, but that is a pretty incredible amount of information to be chewing up on a passively cooled device. None of these have active cooling. I'm going to be testing this on a gaming phone with active cooling because I want to see if it sustains through the second half or if it thermal throttles too. It's fascinating watching that play out. So I'm very excited. I cannot say enough nice things about Photomate R3. The app is not quite as pretty as Adobe software. So it's kind of like if you've ever used Audacity to record audio, it's a little ugly. It definitely feels like last generation UI, but it's nearly as feature complete as Lightroom. I can preset my photo edits. So I just share an XMP file from one phone to another phone and all of that is transferred. And again, I mean, it's like, I don't have to jump through any cloud hoops. I literally just share a 100 kilobyte XMP file from one phone to another. And there are all my presets and there are all my photo tests. There are all my photo adjustments and edits. It's pretty clean. And then on top of that, you pay for it once. I've been really frustrated with KineMaster and PowerDirector and all these other, like, you know, you can edit video on Android and it's only going to cost you $3 a month. And you're like, I don't want subscriptions for every single app that I use. What I want is photo, like this Photomate. And then when they come out with Photomate R4, if I want to, I'll buy it again. But if I'm still happy with Photomate R3, I'll just stick with Photomate R3. This is, again, it's like the pros and cons of, you know, do apps as services, you know, like programs as a service. But I've been spoiled. I've been spoiled by DaVinci Resolve, and I've been spoiled by the open source software that I use, like GIMP. I don't want to pay for Photoshop. GIMP is not as nice as Photoshop. It's not as good. It handles everything that I need to do, though. And it's free. Hey, Fat Produce, you've convinced me, Juan. I've purchased the app. And Simon says, Hypno, DaVinci Resolve is so good. I'm so excited for DaVinci 17. Resolve 17. I like having some of these alternative development, this other idea of how we can monetize software, how we can support software, how we can kind of build it up. And when I find something like this, this is a solid competitor to Lightroom. Excuse me. If you're familiar with how Lightroom works and you already pay for an Adobe Creative Cloud account, Photomate R3 is not as nice. It's not. Lightroom is a little bit prettier. Lightroom is a little bit smoother in operation. Definitely better. I don't want to pay yearly subscription fees for the basic kind of photo editing and processing that I might do in Lightroom. That's not my jam. For someone who is that invested in the Adobe ecosystem, it makes perfect sense. But Photomate gets me like 90% of the way there. And I spent $10 on it and I'm done. Like, that's it. I own the app. I've already installed it on 3 different phones. I've already transferred all of my photo editing templates to 3 phones. I'm good. I'm happy. And that the performance seems to track for some really heavy lifting and some very aggressive use on mobile devices. It's excellent. From Blue Malicious, any app suggestions for combining multiple bracketed images from my mirrorless camera? Actually, I think that's something that Photomate R3 does. I will test that for you because I am now interested in finding a solution for that. But yeah, it has a photo merge setting where you do a selection and instead of doing a batch process, you do a merge. I don't believe it's going to be as sophisticated as Adobe's AI processing for that. But again, if you've done your job in setting your camera up on a tripod or minimizing vibration, you should be good combining that as a bracketed output. Don't go buying this app just yet. Like, go, well, you can install it and use it for free. Just a lot of the stuff like the batch processing is paywalled too, but it's not paywalled behind a subscription. It's paywalled behind a single in-app purchase. But yeah, I mean, give it a run. Give it a try. That's the last part of this chain is you can try it before you buy it. You might not like the layout. I mean, honestly, it is not the prettiest app, but it has been phenomenally useful in starting off what I hope will be another long-term assessment of phone performance. I really like this idea of having a big phone screen with a big battery that can connect directly to one of my nicer mirrorless cameras and using that as a platform for more quickly finishing content out in the field. If it's video content, dropping it directly into a timeline. If it's photo content, being able to manipulate, batch edit, process, upload to another server. I just increasingly, the power and the brains that go into our phone are ridiculously more powerful than what we're really taking advantage of. From Blue Malicious, I'm using one by the maker of Open Camera on Android currently, but it doesn't have the option yet to move the images if one is slightly misaligned. Yeah, I don't know that Photomate's going to solve that issue for you. Again, if it's not like Adobe-style AI processing and manipulation, then it's on you to make sure that your capture is as precise as you can make it. So we're 10:46. We're kind of getting into the last 15 minutes here. And I feel would be a good time. We just want to kind of open up the chat, me spend more time reading through the chat here and have kind of a conversation about things we're thankful for. I've never been the guy to do a whole bunch of Black Friday sales tracking. This has never really been my jam. I don't like Black Friday because it seems to suck all the air out of the room from Thanksgiving. Like, Thanksgiving is this beautiful moment of the year to remember, to celebrate with family, to make a bunch of food, to remember the things that we're thankful for. And then retailers, on top of that, dumped all of this FOMO and aggressive consumerism onto my favorite holiday. Thanksgiving for me is the time where I like to have those conversations about how to get more out of the technology we're thankful for so we don't accidentally buy crap we don't need. Things that become e-waste. When you go to a doorbuster and you get a great deal on that new TV and then you find out it's a special model number of that TV with reduced functionality and reduced capability, and it's not built as well as the actual version of that TV that's for sale the rest of the year. That kind of hype machine is always something that I'm going to be critically frustrated by. If it's, you know, smartphone tech tubers only talking about Samsung or Apple, or if it's Black Friday deal door busters, I don't feel it's good for us. I feel it's bad for us. I think it's just waste. And it gets in the way of us having that conversation about how do we get more value from the things that we buy as opposed to buying more things because we want new shiny. So for me, and kind of as a teaser, you know, let me pull up some of my script notes for the video that I'm going to be putting out right around Thanksgiving. What I've been thankful for in terms of smartphones hasn't really been one phone. I'm not going to do a phone of the year or a top five or these are the winners. I feel like 2019 got kind of a bad rap as a boring year when it was really the last year of peak slab smartphone. From V50s to S10s, iPhone 11 Pros to OnePluses. Sorry, I was spacing on kind of my comparison points there. I feel like 2019 was the final execution of the best version of an LTE glass-on-glass slab sandwich. And I understand why that felt kind of boring to a lot of people, but if you just got hung up on the novelty excitement of of smartphones, then I feel like you missed out on just some of the absolute most polished, streamlined experiences that the smartphone world has had, has ever offered. Again, I pick up an LG G8, and that phone got trashed by popular tech tubers, and it's just peak smartphone. It is peak LG. 4K 60 frame per second software stabilized video from both the main sensor and the ultra wide. Z camera for more secure face scanning while still having a fingerprint sensor on the back. Quad DAC in just delivering the absolute best headphone performance that a mobile device can offer. I mean, that phone is an absolute monster of a daily driver smartphone, like what we think a pocket computer should be. It's still almost unrivaled in what it really delivers in terms of a daily driver experience. Sorry, again, just prattling on about things that I like. What 2020 is exciting for, and what I'm thankful for in 2020, is pushing the boundaries on new form factors and new uses. When it came to just a slab of glass on glass, we haven't been able to convince consumers that they really can do more with their phones. They still use their phones in the same way that they've been using their phones for like the last 5 years. But when we change the hardware and we force them to look at the novelty of a different design, of a different form factor, it suddenly sparks this potential to do more things with it. I pick up a phone like the LG Wing, and honestly, you know, this action is cool. It is super fun. And I think LG has done a wonderful job of incorporating additional use into this little mini bottom screen. But fundamentally, as a computing platform, there's not a lot that the Wing can do that other phones can't. But when you see, you know, like it's got like a touchpad and I can have a mouse cursor, something changes in your brain. I can use a mouse cursor with this screen, and I can open and close programs just like I can on a desktop PC. It starts empowering some new thoughts on what this hardware can do. I get ridiculously excited about a phone like the Duo, not because I think it's such a great phone. It's actually an okay phone, but it's a great tablet that now fits in a different form factor. It can fit in a pocket. Most tablets can't fit in your pocket. This one can. And it opens up the potential for someone to reconsider their relationship with a mobile pocket computer. In 2020, I'm going to be forever grateful for this year in introducing more of these concepts. We had to do it in kind of gimmicky ways, and we had to do it in kind of some silly experimentation. But what we ultimately arrive at is a fresh consumer conversation that should hopefully push the boundaries on all phones. There's no reason why an iPhone 12 shouldn't be able to power an incredible home desktop experience. The only thing stopping consumers from doing it is Apple making a couple key software and hardware decisions that prevent them from doing it. The actual horsepower isn't in question. So I've been looking at some of these products like my Next Dock. Extremely thankful for having a Next Dock. It has proven invaluable in reviewing little mini form factor PCs, helping me repair some of the stuff that's been going on with my main desktop workstation, troubleshooting some of my new home networking, because I'm ripping up. I just installed a new switch so that I can get faster throughput to my NAS. I mean, like, this thing, it just keeps popping up functional and beneficial around the house. So even though I'm not traveling, like the Next Dock was going to be my sort of travel interface so that I could write more effectively and edit video more effectively from my phone, it is still proven incredibly useful all around. And I feel like the last thing that the what I'm going to end my thankful for video are the Focals. Focals by North. Again, just a radical push forward in a new interaction with mobile technology. And it just makes me incredibly sad that we couldn't get that experiment moving more aggressively from a boutique manufacturer, We're going to have to wait for Apple to decide when it's going to be profitable for Apple to deliver some kind of product, which won't work as well. It will not be as brute force functional. I guarantee it. What the Focals were incredible. For a few small teething pains on fit, finish, and how much weight you want to carry on your face. But it just made me incredibly sad going halfway through this year where I had this amazing product that was so helpful in navigating grocery stores during a global pandemic where I don't want to touch things, having all of that information up at eye level, even for something as silly as a grocery list, walking around with an overlay that kept my grocery list up at eye level. I didn't have to touch my phone. It was so brilliant. And so that is the experience I've been most thankful for over this last year, from the end of last year to this year. And it's just so sad. It's such a shame to see it go. So, Dave Burns killed by Google. I mean, like literally, Focals 2 looked like they were going to be such an incredible like refinement of what, and the first Focals were so good. I can't tell you from using like Galaxy smartwatches, and I still wear a Tick watch, like the UI on the Focals was so much more immediate and so much smoother. The interactions were so clean. Its ability to predictive, its text prediction was phenomenal. Speech to text transcription was excellent. It would pick up keywords in your conversations to like serve you up emojis in ways that Samsung and Google haven't even tried yet. And it was all up right in your eye. And to lose that, you know, again, now it's, you know, like when you teach a gorilla sign language, it's like, I feel like I've taken such a huge step back when I'm out in public and I've got to look at a phone or I've got to pull my watch up to my face. And then I've got to like diddle around on my watch screen. It just feels like, again, it feels like such a downgrade. So anyway, that's me. That's the tech I've been most thankful for. I kind of want to just see, I'm going back through the chat right now. Nick Fell, Thanksgiving is incredibly wholesome, followed immediately by the year's most consumerist day. Just makes me really sad. McCorkran 3, they force you to make purchasing decisions under the threat of scarcity. Even if you save a few bucks, that's a strategy and a tendency that'll cost you in the long term. And then also it's often not any better of a deal. I know there are laws against like jacking up the prices before you put things on sale, but I don't know, man. It just seems like so much effort, so much work, so much discomfort. And then you don't really, was it really worth it? To save the little money that you've saved on that kind of stuff.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
So, and McCorkran 3, and I completely understand the sentiment. There's a lot of exciting innovation around form factor, but outside of that, it seems we're getting more computing power that we don't need. That seems to be the likely trend for 2021, I suspect. I totally believe that most consumers are going to walk away from these new crazy powerful Apple A14s and Snapdragon 875s. If you pick up your new phone and you do the exact same things on your new phone that you did on your old phone, it's not going to feel any different. And I'm tragically disappointed in the TechTuber conversation because we're not empowering the education on what it looks like to push more use out of your phone. And this is the right time. People are struggling with additional gadget purchases, driving, work from home, school from home, digital communication. It's, you have a computer in your pocket that can be doing more. And instead of empowering people to do more with them, we've got a bunch of smug tech tubers with wacky thumbnails going, oh, but average consumers don't do things like that. So I need an iPhone 12 Pro Max because the camera's a little bit better and it opens my Snapchat like a fraction of a millisecond faster. Isn't that amazing? And it's not. And so the consumer goes and buys that phone because they see wacky thumbnail after wacky thumbnail. And then their phone is exactly the same because they're doing the exact same things with it. And then they're even less inclined to take tech commentary on YouTube seriously. So you see, I mean, we talked about it. I want to say it was like a month back, maybe 2 months back, where overwhelmingly consumers surveyed felt like there were zero advancements going with new phones and they should be holding onto their old phones longer. That is a tragic failure of phone marketing and phone manufacturing. Because when you drive these devices better, you get so much more out of them. When I mean, like, it's not just some dumb flex where I'm triple apping on a V60. A little Bluetooth keyboard, writing in Microsoft Word, having that sync to the cloud, streaming a video, and keeping up with my Discord. And I can do that anywhere in the world. And I didn't have to travel with my $2,000 gaming laptop. I traveled with my V60. Dual screen case. I have a memory card in there. I often have some headphones or something that I can plug into them because I like that the V60 has a headphone jack and a $50 Bluetooth keyboard. No replicated technology. I don't have another operating system going on. I don't have additional hardware. It's just the phone and the writing experience for what I need to accomplish in Microsoft Word. More than adequate. In fact, faster to get into and out of than booting up a laptop and connecting it to Wi-Fi, because I also have an always-on data connection that I can rely on. Amazing. But telling that to other consumers, they're going to push back against that because they've been told all you do on your phone are phone things. No one is gonna suffer the compromises of not having a laptop to get their work done. But what compromises? You know, the compromise of having to sit down in front of a laptop and open it and boot it up, make sure it's powered or that the battery's charged. Apple is getting around this by making their MacBook more like an iPad. It's there. We've been there for years. So I'm not trying to pick on you, McCorkran. It's just, if we're going to be the tip of the spear, if we're the techies in these conversations and talking to our family and friends, that's what we have to chat about. Next year, I am going to push more of my family members to Pixel A series, iPhone SEs, Galaxy FEs maybe, but probably also Galaxy A series, like an A71, beautiful phone, phenomenal, and way more phone than most of my family members need. No FOMO, they're not missing anything. They're not using any Galaxy S stuff. They're Galaxy A consumers who have been trained to only shop at the top tier. But at the same time, I'm going to point out, hey, if you're doing this or you need to work on the go, or you just want to be able to work out in your backyard and not have to worry about how to power a laptop out there, a phone accessory and your phone are going to get all this stuff done. You're on Zoom calls, you're on web connected services, cloud storage, and Microsoft Office or Google Docs. You don't even need a Chromebook. Like, even a Chromebook is an unnecessary extra computer because your phone is already doing all of this. So it's just frustrating because I understand the feeling. But it's the void that I feel like I'm shouting into every day to say, don't buy this unless you want to do more. But if you want to do more, there's so much more you could be doing. Just a couple other comments here, and then we'll start closing this down. But Dave Burns, the genius behind the focals is that you can literally look past their display. Again, eye contact while you're getting information up in your sort of digital sphere. I miss that so much. I get a text and I look down at my watch and then I look back at you versus on the focals. Like, I'd be looking at the camera and then that would be the look away just to get a piece of information. And it was a better gatekeeper for what information was being popped up on my eye. I miss it so much. Oh, and even like, you know, interacting with the Discord, there were so many times where I'd get like a Discord notification. I'd read through the comment, click the little microphone icon, just talk into the air. And that would be my reply on the Discord. I miss it. I miss them so. I miss them every day. I miss them so much. From Vasic the Sixth, I'm thankful that LG has their Explorer program and that the Wing exists. I hope they have a second gen with flagship specs. Blue Malicious, imagine if everyone thought they needed the latest desktop i9 in their basic last laptop because it was the top processor. I don't get why we do the same with phones, and we really shouldn't be. And it's very wasteful, and it puts so much economic pressure on people. And again, I pick up an iPhone SE. As a daily driver at a glance notification communication machine, it is tough to beat. I pick up a Pixel 4a, and there are so many things I like about that phone better than more expensive devices. It's not a compromise. It's really not. I'm from Aditya Anil. I know I use my G7 more than most people. I'm still doing fine, aside from some occasional battery problems. So we're going to be replacing Marie's G7. So I had the G7 and I gave it to her as sort of like a loaner. We were looking at what phones to buy. The whole world went crazy. She's just kept it. I think she really genuinely likes that phone, but we just noticed. And we don't know when or how it happened, but the entire back is shattered in her case. So we really do need to look at replacing her phone, but she's pretty much decided on a Pixel 4a. She wants a headphone jack and she wants a smaller phone. So I think that's going to be her jam. And again, like in operation, in the hand, daily driver feel, she's not going to notice any differences, and she's probably going to like the camera a little bit better than what the G7, because she never really shoots manual. If she shot more in the sort of manual or pro mode, I'd say, maybe. But shooting full auto? Nah, Pixel. Every single time. I'm from Pacostin. Are there any plans to check out the new FX Tech phone? I really want to, and especially I really want to try a competing operating system on that hardware. But unfortunately, I'm still way behind on the phones I have in-house to review. I'm working out my budget for what next year's device budget is going to look like, because I got to be really careful not to overspend. I still want to circle back to an iPhone 12 maybe early next year, maybe January, February, get a good iPhone 12 camera review out there just to see what all the hubbub is about, because I don't think it's going to be anything revolutionary. And then also, I need to do a better job of covering Samsung more topically, because I completely dropped the ball on the Galaxy S20. Again, it was the world and all of the surroundings of what happened in the world around us, but I didn't have a backup plan to fix that. I didn't have a way to pivot or course correct, and I didn't get to do anything Samsung until the Note. And even then, it was sort of a... like it was a done conversation before I even had my hands on that phone. So I want to do a little bit better for all of my Samsung snark and how much I really do not like doing business with that company now. But I feel like it's a more prescient conversation for consumers than me just side playing it all the time. Aditya Nanel, Mrs. Gadget Guy is definitely a savvy consumer. Again, she's even without my prattling on about technology, I think she's got a pretty solid sense of her actual needs and then looking at price tags and then going like, but what would I do with that? I love that that's the question that she asks, because she's not going to be one to try and push the boundaries on mobile work from a pocket device. So I haven't had too many concerns there. It's more, she's really good at destroying those gadgets. So it just makes me kind of sad, because I liked that G7 and it's proper cracked now. From Dave Burns, the note was a shrug. It's a bit of a disappointment. No. The note is a note, and it's a beastly powerful computer with amazing capabilities and some interesting decisions on things like cameras and decks. And again, it is a premium tier product that deserves to be a premium tier product. The Note 20 can rot. The gimped Note, I feel, is a terrible buy. Just an absolutely ludicrously bad investment for any tech fan. The Ultra makes some sense as a premium tier device if you're looking to really push a mobile computing experience. It was just disappointing that the general tech tuber conversation was Galaxy S20 with an S Pen. Here are some of the differences. The zoom isn't as good as the Ultra. It's not worth it for the monies. Smash that bell icon. I mean, the conversation on the Note was over. You know, like look at the type of ennui, the type of disappointment people have when like phone prices change. You saw all of those like tittering editorials about like the Duo. There are Black Friday sales. You can get a Duo for $200 off. Well, there was a sale on the Duo. And everyone's like, oh, see, look, even Microsoft, they had to cut the price on the Duo. And oh, how upset would you be if you bought a Duo and then 2 months later they cut the price by $200 and they're trading and this and that and you've got to exchange it, blah, 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 blah. The Galaxy Note 20 Ultra hit a very similar $200 price reduction 3 weeks. 3 weeks after it launched. Did we blow up all of the Samsung has failed consumer disappointment, not worth it for the monies, never buy, blah, 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 blah? Did we explode all over the Note 20 price reduction in 3 weeks like we did when the Duo got a $200 price reduction 2 months after it launched? No, we did not. So I find this is utter gamification. You know, Galaxy S20 is going to be doing better for your search engine optimization. S20 FE is going to be doing better for your search engine optimization than the Note. So in the hierarchy of popularity, the Note is a foregone conclusion loser to the S20 for what most average consumers need. But because the Note is still probably going to be better search engine traffic than a Duo, well, I mean, the Duo Microsoft can't do anything right. I mean, if you want it, you should just get a Note, you know, like, and it's so obvious, the gamification and the stratification. As soon, it's kind of like the Big Bang Theory. Whoever the smartest person in the room is the mockable individual, right? You know, it's just so mean-spirited and painfully obvious that when you're talking about a product, if it's popular, then it's the winner. If it's more popular, then it wins more. And same thing, like LG getting the most positive headlines that they've ever gotten on the Velvet, because LG will likely perform better for search than the Duo. And that is not the comparison. Why would you buy the Duo when you can get basically the same thing and it's cheaper and you should get a Velvet? Suddenly, tech tubers were looking at LG as if they had something decent to offer. And like, LG's been around. I don't know where you guys have been. Nice of you to show up now that they're doing something kind of interesting, but cool, I guess. But it was all hinged on that hierarchy of search. Whatever was going to do better for their video performance was the winner, not the actual comparison and showdown between different devices. And that's what I'm least thankful for in the year 2020 is just how obvious the gamification of that review process has become. Because it's clear. I mean, again, I'm sure if you were to pin someone down who I feel emulates that model of tech commentary, they would deny it. And I think even in their brain, they don't realize fully that that's the extent of how they've been programmed to respond to things by the YouTube algorithm. But there's no other data to suggest that these devices are being fairly compared and ranked based on their merit. And that the only thing that seems to matter is the payout, is the ad revenue. Blue Malicious, I feel like the Note 9 was peak Note, and I feel like everyone would agree. If there's any Note I need to add to my collection as a museum piece, it's the Note 9. It's not going to be a Note 10. It's definitely not going to be a Note 20. Yeah, I feel like the Note 9 was the last no compromise example of Samsung pushing the Note as a tech platform. And it's sad. So the problem, Baseball Super says, if LG made a G9 this year, they would have done well because the Samsungs with Exynos were a flop. And the problem is one of marketing. If LG had made a G9, all of the tech YouTubers would have said, it's not good enough. You should just buy a Samsung. Samsung still, as far as I can determine from quarterly to quarterly and from year to year, Samsung has fallen to be the number two in marketing back behind Procter & Gamble. So you're talking about a company that's likely spending around $11 billion a year on marketing. And there's no way LG can compete with that in their current state, in their current financials. And it's also one of the reasons why a phone like the Galaxy Note 20 exists at $1,000, is because you have to pay for $10 billion a year marketing somehow. It gets rolled into the consumer prices of these devices. So, no, I actually think LG's strategy, is as disappointing as it is from a power user perspective, is the right consumer play. If you're going to make the argument that like the G series was more of the consumer focused pretty phone series, Velvet is a better play. It's easier to sell to carriers. It's less expensive, so consumers are more interested just in that final price, and it performs exactly. I mean, again, it's still overpowered for your daily driver smartphone interactions. It's the right move. It makes me sad because I want to see more devices pushing the boundaries on that kind of use, but it doesn't make sense for LG to keep getting, you know, the crap kicked out of them by reviewers and having phones sit on store shelves and then go to the bargain bin. You know, if you only bought LG at extreme price reductions because they were just trying to move product off of store shelves, great, you got a great deal. You did. But then you don't get a follow-up. You don't get another phone when the only time LGs are worth it for the monies are when they're like, you know, $200 for an LG G8, brand new. Cool. I'm glad you got that deal. You'll never get another one. And especially here in North America, LG's customers are not consumers. LG's customers are the carriers. They have a deal to sell the phone to carriers, and then they don't have to worry. The carriers are going to deal with those phones sitting in inventory. But that's why we don't get unlocked phones anymore from LG. If they can't strike up a carrier deal, that phone is not going to be sold in that region. And that's the reality of this market now. Because it's either that or they need to spend $15 billion a year just on marketing so that they can start to climb up to some of the same mindshare as Samsung. And that's not going to happen. From Tech Love and Mama, I love my Note 20 Ultra, but I wish I'd bought another Note 10, Note 10 Plus, because I like the camera bump and Aura Glow a lot. The larger camera module makes me feel like I'm going to break my camera area since it's less protected than any other Surface. Yeah, and we've seen those larger Samsung camera modules are pretty fragile. From Dave Burns, do you think this is an active choice or do you think editors have been trained by the algorithm and this is subconscious? I think it's both. you are, whenever you log into YouTube, you're immediately, it's shoved in your face how you're underperforming. Like, I get red arrows. This video didn't do as well. You need to work on these metrics. Your ad revenue is down. It's all just a cycle of reinforcing kind of the worst aspects of production. And so I think that kind of informs, even if it's a subtle, if it's in kind of the back of your brain, it informs an idea, well, I need to work on making these popular videos. So then you put out a video and it does really well. And then that's like, oh, well, maybe I should make more videos like that. When I left Pocket Now, we had very real conversations about only making deep dive analysis and reviews on Samsung and Apple. And it was one of the reasons why I left. At the time, our real camera and real audio reviews, huge spikes on Samsung, huge spikes on Apple, solid spikes on Huawei, and then nothing on LG, HTC, Motorola, maybe a bit of a blip on a OnePlus, but everyone just took it for granted that all OnePlus cameras were garbage, so it wasn't worth it to invest the time to review them properly. Because when you review them properly, you find that they're actually competitive cameras, they just have some weird quirks. So we had pitch meetings where the main takeaway was, we can't keep investing the same time, money, effort, and energy into an LG camera review if it's only going to do, you know, 20% the traffic of a Samsung. So again, I think it's both. I think the general fog of popularity and trending topics is reinforced by YouTube. And then that leads to outright critical decisions about how you're going to strategize and create your content. And it's completely emblematic on my channel. I mean, I make videos about what I want to make videos about. My monetization is garbage and my views are really low. I mean, for 120,000 subscribers, like 2,000 to 3,000 views on a video about a topic that I care about, but I made the video that I wanted to. And then YouTube is way less likely to like share my videos. It's an odd discovery platform for me, and it's really not worth it. And eventually that entire relationship craters, you know, like maybe I just go to making all of my videos for Patreon, or I jump ship and I go work for PR and I'm just not making review commentary anymore. You come to that conclusion when it makes sense financially for you to come to that conclusion. But unfortunately, it's a downward spiral, and I'm pretty confident I'm on the losing end of it. I don't feel this is a nosedive we pull out of. I feel this is a market that craters. I hope I'm wrong, and I'm putting together subreddits and trying to popularize other content creators, and I'm trying to work against that system. But I don't see any evidence to suggest that I come out of this correct against YouTube. I'm pretty sure YouTube is going to win. And Blue Malicious, I really want to see more Dimensity driven phones next year. I'd love to see more chipset competition. From Vasek the Sixth, do people not want a flagship phone with a smaller screen anymore? Those options seem to be dwindling. There is a challenge. I mean, again, I've spoken to some LG engineers and I've spoken to some Lenovo engineers. It's not easy making a smaller screened 5G phone and packing in the battery. I mean, there are some crazy challenges. And again, I feel like Sony and Google deserve a ton of credit for making like the same form factor phone for the Xperia 5 and including a larger battery and in some regions, including 5G support. And same thing for a Pixel. The Pixel 5 is an astounding engineering accomplishment. That battery capacity, that radio management, compatibility with Verizon ultra wideband. I mean, like, whatever your feelings on the phone, if you can't get over yourself to give Google some kudos on actually making that thing, then you're bad at tech. I mean, you're proper bad at tech to not be able to appreciate what goes into a smaller phone like that. But it's hard, which makes it more expensive. That's why a phone like the Velvet is a little less expensive to produce and actually pads out the profit margins a little bit better. It's because you just have more surface. You have more volume to put that stuff into it. But I agree with you. I would love to see more options for small form factor premium phones. It's just with the understanding and the knowledge that that is actually a point where costs might increase. It's not just the larger big screen phones demanding the higher price tags anymore. We're kind of making small form factor phones boutique. And from Nick Fell, I don't think you can go only Patreon. I think you need a free platform as a discovery platform, even if you expect no income from it. And I just would question, why would YouTube be my only opportunity for a free discovery platform? If I have to drive all of my traffic to YouTube anyway by using social media, and YouTube is not acting as a good discovery platform or a good search platform for my videos anymore, then why should I make free content for YouTube distribution to try and encourage more discovery when I'm already using Twitter and Reddit and other methods of outreach? Again, it's not a threat. It's not like, oh, I'm going to pull the plug tomorrow. I'm not getting enough attention. But it's the reality of this. Every outlet you follow is having a conversation about, how do we monetize? How do we pay for the talent that goes into this production? How do we keep the lights on? And a lot of them are working against YouTube's implementation of revenue. If it's sponsorships, if it's affiliate links, if it's direct contributions, if it's setting up a side platform that's monetized directly by the community, everyone's working against YouTube. Unbox Therapy and MKBHD have their own podcasts. Because they, even the darlings of tech YouTube with some of the biggest communities on the platform, they also need to have some kind of content distribution platform that is completely under their control and is not dictated completely by the whims of YouTube's algorithm. I'm kind of saying the quiet parts out loud here. I'm kind of, airing some of my dirty laundry here, but this isn't a mystery. Everyone is working against the YouTube model. The people that lean into it, even like a Linus, yeah, it's all clickbait now. It's all wacky thumbnails, and he's literally messing with the audience because he is recognizing the challenges of keeping a production team funded and fed by mostly publishing and popularizing on YouTube. But what does he have as a side platform to encourage increased monetization? So if YouTube isn't getting the views on my channel, what am I missing? what am I lacking? We're streaming this podcast on Twitch right now. This podcast will be uploaded to YouTube later. what's the danger? So again, it's not a I'm so angry and I'm going to keep complaining about YouTube on YouTube. At some point, you just got to change. At some point, you just got to change your behavior, because if you're just continuing to hope that something will change doing the same business you've always done with YouTube, then that's not going to happen. Bagnell plane. Yeah, I'll do my own float plane. I'll do fly plane. Why would you want a plane that floats? I've got a plane that flies. Now give me money directly. Yeah. So again, and Nick Fell, I mean, I get what you're saying. Patreon is incredibly bad discoverability. I think you'd lose viewers without a free discoverable platform. I mean, yeah, that's what I just said. Where are you watching this live stream, Nick? Are you watching this on YouTube? When I upload this to YouTube, are you going to watch it on YouTube? Are you going to discover this podcast on YouTube? My numbers don't get that much better when I co-stream on Twitch and YouTube. Adding a whole extra service where I have 120,000 subscribers might add 20 to 30 more viewers to this live stream in real time. So, again, discoverability isn't Google. I mean, it's mostly Google, but it's not entirely Google. So again, making that transition and making that change, yeah, I might, but if I'm already the main reason why I'm drawing new viewers to the channel is through my own social media interactions and working on other platforms, then I don't feel like I'm missing too much. I got the fly. Whew, was bugging me this whole podcast. Get it? Bugging me. All right. This is already sort of like descending into a topic and a conversation stream. And I'm already running this podcast way longer than I'd intended to. And we had wrapped that up on some nice sort of what we're thankful for tech chat. And I feel like that's kind of the end point, the thing that I want to end us out on. The only reason why I have these conversations about what YouTube does is because if you don't have that media literacy about what YouTube, how YouTube manipulates the content on their platform, then that's bad for you. I feel like it's bad when we talk about Facebook. So, you know, we should also look at other examples where it's just as bad. And jumping through these hoops and trying to play ball and appease these algorithms is not good, which is why I am so thankful to have conversations with people in a community that try to look past just this surface level examination. Doing something just because it's good for your existence on YouTube is not good for the long-term health of a content creator. The psychological health, the business health, the financial health, only playing YouTube's game is bad. And there's no data that someone can show me right now that would suggest otherwise, because every major player that we see on the platform is working against some aspect of how that platform manages content. If I say something radical like, maybe I'll just go all paywall, it's not that radical. Not with a whole series of other crowdfunding initiatives, of paywall subscription initiatives, and of working on other platforms. Again, like, I'm having to pick and choose. It's not like Amazon is such an altruistic entity in this space. I'm definitely having to do something kind of crazy going from Google to Amazon in terms of my streaming. But if we don't, then we're going to be stuck under this monopolistic idea of how YouTube can treat all of the people that fuel their platform with content. So that's why these conversations are so refreshing. I feel if we don't point this stuff out, or if we don't comment on it, or if we don't try to find solutions around it, then we're stuck with business models that we don't like. It's good in the short term to play ball and become sort of YouTube precious or YouTube popular, but it's bad in the long term. So let me wrap this up on just like a more on a friendlier note. Like I said at the top of this podcast, you know, the Thanksgiving situation is going to be really challenging for me. It is tough, like looking at what we normally do to celebrate this time of year, to come together, to remember the good times and to talk about the more challenging times, and not having that this year is going to be tough. But I'm hoping that those of you out there having those conversations with your family and friends, finding alternatives, it's not going to be as fun. A Zoom call is not as good. It's not as good as driving up to my parents' place, you know, snowy mountainside in New Mexico, getting out of a cold car, unbuckling Lex from her car seat and running into a warm house and getting hugs and cider and green chili stew is ready in a crock pot. Not as good. Zoom call, pretty crap compared to what we would normally do traveling for Thanksgiving. But we can. We have that capability. We have that ability to reach out. I hope that beyond just my normal, you know, I hope you're safe, warm, well-fed, and spending time with people you care about. I hope you're able to take some time over this next week to reach out. Reach out to a neighbor. Reach out to a friend you haven't spoken to in a while. Reach out to a family member who, you know, might be off the grid or off the radar, not contributing on Facebook like they used to. I hope you have the time to make some of those conversations happen again. And because it's kind of a magical, in the most terrible way possible, in just the most difficult, most terrible way possible, it is kind of incredible that we have these tools, that we have this capability, that we can do these things. And I hope you find those opportunities to really put them to use. And I think it'll mean a lot to your family. I think it'll mean a lot to your friends. I think it'll be good for you too. So again, my normal wrap up. This whole week is food week as far as I'm concerned. I hope you're safe. I hope you're warm. I hope you're well fed. And I hope you get to spend some time with people who care about you. So on behalf of the Bagnell family, the SGG community, and everyone else who might be listening or watching or streaming this, not on YouTube, I want you to have a happy Thanksgiving. If that means incorporating some technology, then yes, I want you to have an amazing week with your technology. But if it also means unplugging from your technology and just taking care of yourself, hey, do that too. So again, be safe, be well, do awesome with your tech, and I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.